Welcome to Wisdom Wide Open Radio. Join me, your host, Susie Bonham Craig, and special co-host Dennis Stewart, as we embark on another journey to open the portal of wisdom. I invite you to participate in the chat room and call in with your questions on 718-305-6584 and press 1 to enter the queue. And now, our journey begins. Soulmates and journeyers, welcome to another episode of Wisdom Wide Open Radio. Boy, it's a baker today. It's pretty hot around the country from what I hear. And we're just really pleased that we have a different kind of a show this evening. You know, typically Wisdom Wide Open Radio, we bring forth some information and some wisdoms and insights from people who, you know, help us on our journeys of self-awareness. And today what we want to focus on is actually the awareness of the cosmos around us and the world around us. And I'm really excited to be delving into this discovery. I met our special featured guest, George Hoff, who will be joining us today. And what we'll be delving into is what the planet Mars and the Mesoamerican culture have in common. And before I bring George on, I'd just like to tell you a little bit about him. I met him at a 2012 conference. Came on as a speaker at the conference, which was a surprise to all of us, on the heels of Richard Hoagland. And George is the founder and the premier investigator of the Cydonia Institute. And this is Cydonia, spelled C-Y-D-O-N-I-A, not like Sedona, although we'll be delving into that as well. And he's a sculptor and a former director of the Sculptors Association of New Jersey, and is also a member of both the Pre-Columbian Society of Washington, D.C., and the University of Pennsylvania. And what we'll be doing is delving into his current book, The Cydonia Codex, of which has been expanded on, and we'll be going into the Martian Codex as well. So without any further ado, I'd like to bring on George Hoff. Welcome, George.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me on your wonderful show.
Oh, it's great to have you. Hey, Dennis, say hi to our callers and listeners.
Hello, everyone.
All right, we're happy that you joined us. Now, George, you know, as a young child, I was really into astronomy and then into astrology, and I kind of followed all the woo-woo mysticism. But you bring some really cold, hard facts about specifically with the planet Mars, and this was with regard to, I guess it pinpointed, you know, in the last 30 years that NASA's Viking orbiter captured the image of this colossal humanoid face on the surface of Mars, that no theory has really fully been explained or, you know, explaining the meaning or the origin of this phenomenon. And so I'd like you to start, if you could, in sharing with our listeners What is it that spiked you? What is it that really inspired you to take this journey?
Well, you're right. This whole story begins with NASA taking a photograph of a structure on Mars that even some of the NASA scientists and employees there, when they were going through the images that were coming back from Mars, actually thought looked like a face. And NASA initially titled this The Head. And they actually had a press conference at the time that summer. The image was taken in July of 1976 and released to the public as an anomaly that they had found this structure that kind of looked like a face. And it got a lot of press attention early on when they released this image. And a lot of people saw it as, you know, tongue-in-cheek, like it was a novelty or something. And then a few days later, NASA had another press conference and announced that they had taken a second photograph of this structure and proved that it was just a trick of light and shadow and there was nothing there. And the interesting thing about this the second image. At the time, this is back in 1976, no one questioned the media or NASA about presenting the image. They just said, oh, well, that's that, and that was the end of it. But as we all know, that story did not end there.
Okay. Well, it didn't end there, so where is it going to take us?
Well, as time went on, early on, there was a pair of researchers at NASA that worked for Goddard Space Center, DiPietro and Molinar. They were both scientists there, and they had an interest in this structure. And in 1980, they had put out a scientific paper evaluating the face on Mars. And they had actually found other structures in the area, in the Cydonia area where the so-called face was found, that structures that also looked to be artificial. Most important was the pyramidal-shaped pyramid that was just down below where the face on Mars was, that was like a five-sided pyramid. Over the years, that's become known as the D&M pyramid, named after DiPietro and Molinar. Right after DiPietro and Molinar's monograph came out, was basically ignored by the major scientific community. Around 1984, Richard Hoagland put together a group of researchers, and they did some independent study, and of course Hoagland came out with his book, The Monuments of Mars, which basically focused on the D&M pyramid and the face on Mars. And Hoagland had found, through Molinar research, where they had found that second image of the face on Mars that NASA had taken and presented to the public, that this was the image that they had taken that proved that it was just a pile of rocks. Actually, that second image had much more detail. You could actually see evidence of an eye, a mouth, a nose, and you could see actual features on the eastern side of the structure that in the initial release was kind of dark. And through some enhancements that DiPietro and Molinar did, they could bring some of these features out. So Richard Hoagland looked at it, and he had, on a, I guess, a whim, or I don't know how this actually happened, he was just basically trying to see the symmetry of the face. And what he did was he did a mirroring of the, which we call the western side, which is the humanoid side. So he did a mirroring of it just to see what it would look like as a symmetrical structure. And it was pretty striking. He noticed that, you know, it had this very humanoid look to it. And after he had that success, you know, just to see what that structure would look like, he decided to do a mirroring of the darker side, which was in the shadow, of course, which was the eastern side. And much to his surprise, when he mirrored that, it looked a lot like a lion or a feline. And immediately, the connection to the Sphinx in Egypt came to his mind, thinking that this was that same embodiment of man and nature that you see in Egypt with the Sphinx, you know, the crouching lioness with the human head. So the same juxtaposition of the human and feline he was seeing in the face on Mars, which was pretty astonishing. And, of course, his book came out, which, you know, of course, caused a lot of controversy. Again, mainstream scientists basically ignored all of his research.
Okay. Now, before we get into that, because we definitely want to bring that up for discussion, George, you know, about why this has been kept under wraps, what the possibilities could be, because we understand, and for people that haven't read George's book or even just looked at these phenomenal photographs, can we just say that all of these photographs that you conducted your research upon are available to the general public?
Yes, all of these original Viking images, back in the 70s, you had to be in the scientific community, basically, to get access to these. Richard Hoagland worked with a group of scientists, and they actually, you know, they just basically sent letters to NASA requesting copies, you know, for their research. And, you know, months would go by, and they'd get a package in the mail with all of these printouts of the Viking data tapes, you know, which is this old antiquated type of process. So you really had to get involved to actually have access to this. It really wasn't available to the general public. So he was having access to these images with all of this group of independent researchers that he was working with. So they were all evaluating these, like, 8x10 glossies of these images.
Okay, so what provoked you to take this a step further?
Well, like most people, in 1976, if they can recall The Face on Mars, you know, I heard about it. I was in high school at the time. And, you know, it seemed like the case was closed because NASA was very quick with saying that they had taken another image. What Hoagland and DiPietro and Molinaro found out, that second picture was actually taken months later, not actually because of the orbit of the Viking orbiter going around the planet. There was only so many opportunities that the camera would come around and take another picture. You know, it wasn't taken 3 days later. So the second picture was actually taken months later. And
okay.
So,
are you there, George?
Hello?
Hello, you there?
I'm sorry, my phone dropped out.
Okay. And possibly if you could speak a little bit louder. We have some people in the chat room that asked if you could speak a little louder.
Okay. So we were talking about, is that loud enough?
Yeah, we can.
Yes,
yeah,
this is good.
Okay. Sometimes I guess I move the phone away from my mouth. So we were discussing the different images that NASA was taking of the original Viking photographs of the face on Mars, which DiPietro and Molinaro had done the enhancements of, and Richard Hoagland was doing his research and making the mirroring images. And he had found that the left side was a humanoid side and the right side was the feline. Now, really nothing was accomplished with these poor Viking images that were taken in 1976. So we really didn't have any new images to look at to evaluate until 1998, when the Mars Global Surveyor took much better pictures. And they were released in April of 1998. I had made contact with Richard Hoagland in 1996, prior to the Mars Global Surveyor release of the face on Mars, which was, of course, a higher-resolution image. And I was very intrigued. I think that's what you're asking, how I got involved in this. Well, like I was saying, everyone else had probably seen the original pictures in 1976, and I really hadn't had any contact with, you know, any information about this until around 1990. I was actually in a bookstore, and I had seen a book put out by Randolfo Puzo. He actually does the foreword for our new book. And his book was titled The Face on Mars, Evidence for a Lost Civilization. And that was actually my first introduction to this anomaly. And I purchased his book, and that's where I was really intrigued. And I thought that this structure that NASA had photographed was a lot more intriguing than what NASA was you know, discussing with the public. So from that point on, I was very anticipating the new 1998 images of the face that were coming out from the Mars Global Surveyor. So in 1996, my wife and I had gone to Washington. There was an exhibit on Olmec art that was at the National Gallery there.
Okay.
And going through the exhibit, I noticed that there was these Olmec images that had these bifurcated masks, where they had like a humanoid type face on one side, which was like a were-jaguar type of transformational face, and on the other side would be a feline. So initially, when I saw that, I made the connection to the images that Richard Hoagland was mirroring, showing the humanoid and the feline side on the face on Mars. So I had called. I had Richard Hoagland's phone number because I had the. He had put out a quarterly journal with his group through his Mars research, and interestingly, right on the journal on the back of the cover, there was Richard Hoagland's home address in New Jersey and his phone number, so you could actually give him a call. So I had access to his number, and I gave Richard a call, and called him a few times, left a message, and he finally called me back. And I discussed with him my trip down to Washington, And my exposure to these Mesoamerican masks that had this bifurcated iconography in them. And he was very intrigued by that. And he also was anticipating, you know, seeing these new images. So over the years, you know, we had communicated back and forth through phone conversations about discussing, you know, our independent research. So in 1998, NASA finally released the new high-resolution image of the face on Mars. And we found that not only did the new image verify what Richard Hoagland had found with the old Viking image, that the face was actually this bifurcated, two-faced structure, where you had this humanoid face on one side and a feline on the other. Now, Richard and other researchers early on, because of this feline and humanoid appearance of the face on Mars, made a lot of connections with Egyptian art because of the Sphinx. So when we saw the new image, it seemed to have this like flanged headdress on the humanoid side, kind of like you would see on Egyptian mask, like King Tut, where they have this flanged type headdress. And so we were seeing the same thing on the face on Mars with the humanoid side, having this long flanged headdress, which seemed to have furrows and lines running down it. The thing that jumped out at us was when we did a similar type mirroring of the face on Mars was that at the forehead there was this tri-leaf symbol, which looked like a W. It was very much like a leaf or a flower shape. And that we're very intrigued by that, and you would think that if this was an Egyptian motif, that it would be some type of serpent or something like you normally see with Egyptian iconography. However, what we were seeing was this tri-leaf symbol at the forehead. This was in the duplicated or the mirrored image of the humanoid side of the face. So doing some research, going to the library, going through books, we quickly found that this same type of idea with this tri-leaf symbol was found in Mesoamerica with the Olmec and the Maya. And not only did we find that the cultures of Mesoamerica had this tri-leaf symbol on the forehead, a lot of the Olmec old mask and things of even Aztec and Maya showed these flanged headdresses that they would wear. So right from the beginning, we found these two matching motifs that we were finding on the face on Mars with Mesoamerican culture. So with the humanoid side of the face, when it was duplicated, you know, to create a symmetrical face, we were seeing this tri-leaf symbol, which we found was actually based on a corn symbol, which goes all the way back to the founding Olmec culture. The tri-leaf symbol basically symbolizes a sprouting corn sprout. And that was used as a symbol of royalty because in Mesoamerican art, a lot of this corn motifs go back to the first lord, which was one of the first gods of the Maya, which is all connected to the process of growing corn, the corn god. So it just made sense that they would have this corn tri-leaf symbol as a symbol of royalty, denoting the first lord.
And okay, go ahead, George.
So we have the tri-leaf symbol on the forehead. We have the flanged headdress on the side of the face. And not only are we seeing that, A lot of researchers in the beginning looking at this new Mars Global Surveyor image in 1998 were stunned that there was no nose. There was no real main nose feature. And what we see is that the area that would encompass the nose area has this very strange, almost butterfly-shaped nose ornament covering the nose. And we found that in Mesoamerican culture, there's these nose ornaments that they wear that basically cover the nose at times. So again, we're finding, you know, the similar iconography. In the mouth area, there seems to be one main large tooth with a little circular dot on it, which is very intriguing. It's almost like he's like buck tooth, you know, with this one tooth there. So of course, when you mirror it and you duplicate it, it creates, of course, two large teeth in the front. Again, with Mesoamerican iconography, we found that the Maya and the Aztec Olmec cultures would do this dental implants of like jade beads and things like that, that they would do these little circular dot implants on the teeth. So all of this, these features that we were seeing on the face, all seem to coincide with all this iconography and these motifs that we were seeing in the pre-Columbian cultures.
Okay, so George, I don't mean to interrupt you, but you know, for people that aren't aware of what you're describing, maybe if we could paint a larger picture for them about really how profound the size of these land structures on Mars are, and possibly how, you know, you're coming to, I guess, figure out how they actually came into existence. I mean, here we are on planet Earth, and we obviously the home of the Mesoamerican culture, the Olmec and the Mayans, and yet, you know, did we have the technology to be able to replicate those faces and those bifurcations that you've seen on Mars and bring them here, or does it suggest something else?
Well, the face on Mars is very large. The aerial view, when you look down, it's basically about a mile wide and a mile and a half high, width-wise. So
okay.
it's a huge structure. They're not small objects or formations. And these are, I guess, that large, so you'll be able to see them from above, kind of like the NASCAR lines and a lot of these American Indian mounds and things that are out in the Midwest that you see as you fly over. So these were basically, we think, they're like these large geoglyphic structures that are meant to obviously be seen from above, you know, to be seen by passerbys. Now, getting back to the face on Mars with all this iconography on the western side, the left, the interesting thing that we found, not only were we seeing all this Mesoamerican iconography, which we found accidentally, it was only because of the W or tri-leaf symbol on the forehead that actually led us to look at all this Mesoamerican stuff, that the opposite side is a feline. It's like a it looks like a lion, actually, because it has a mane, or this zigzag-shaped mane on the chin. Now, I'm sure a lot of people in the audience are wondering, well, if you have this Mesoamerican mask, there's no lions in Mexico. But, well, this is the other interesting thing we found. Because when Bill and I were doing this research, we didn't know anything about the Maya or the Olmec. We basically, you know, our education from this is what we learned in school and maybe what we read from National Geographic. It was very general. And until we saw this symbol that we started doing the research. And we also found that the Mesoamerican cultures had this mythological creature called a bearded jaguar, because, of course, there's jaguars in Mexico. And they envisioned this mythological creature called the bearded jaguar. So we were saying that this feline side might have been one of these snarling jaguars with this false beard, or this, you know, the bearded jaguar. So all of this seemed to fall in place. Now, all of this information that we've been discussing here about the Mesoamerican connection with the face on Mars is only with this one structure. And the Sedona area is just full of these similar type bifurcated masks. Now, right below the face on Mars is another huge structure that Tom Van Frandelen of the Meta Research Group, he had called the animal early on. He said the structure kind of looked like an animal face. And we did the same thing basically with that structure that Richard Hoagland originally did with the early Viking image. We looked at the structure. We saw the very interesting facial features that appeared to be on the structure. And following this idea of this bifurcated motif, we could see that possibly one side was maybe a rabbit, because it seemed to have a big ear that went up on one side. And it had a very rabbit-looking muzzle with, you know, the little buck-type teeth and things. And the other side had this huge nose and jowls and looked like an orangutan. And we're thinking, why is there this two-faced orangutan and a rabbit? I mean, I ask you, does that make any sense? So what we did, we did the mirroring, which we now call duplication, because a lot of people get nervous when they hear mirroring. But actually, we also found that a lot of archaeologists dealing with Mesoamerican art, which is at times composite images and cut in half faces and things that are just presented as a half of an image. They incorporate this mirroring technique, which they call duplication or reconstruction, to make the whole. So we did this mirroring or duplication of the left and right side of this structure that Tom Van Thranlen called the animal, and we saw that the left side was this rabbit face, and the other side appeared to be like an orangutan or a simian type of monkey. So following the lead with this Mesoamerican connection with the face on Mars, with the face having this humanoid and feline side, we very quickly found that through Maya mythology, there was the famous Hero twins, which were two brothers, which were twins. And they had a second set of brothers that were monkeys. And then one of the brothers was a monkey scribe, and he had a counterpart, one of the other scribes. These were like the sacred beings, supernatural beings, that would keep track of all of the history. You know, of course, they wrote everything down. They were the scribes. So we find, interestingly, that we find this structure on Mars that has a rabbit on one side and an orangutan-like monkey on the other side, that in Mesoamerican culture, they had the two scribes. They had a rabbit scribe and a monkey scribe. So again, we're finding direct correlations with these Mesoamerican cultures with these structures that we're finding on Mars. Now, not to bore the audience any further, we found the same correlation with all these other structures surrounding the face on Mars. We're finding these bifurcated faces, different half images on each side, and not only did each side complete a facial features in correct orientation and size and had recognizable iconography attached, they had direct correlations with these cultures of Mesoamerica in their mythology and their history, which was pretty amazing. Are you there?
Yeah, I definitely found the howler monkey pretty intriguing.
Right, and we also, up in the between the ears of the rabbit, if anybody out there in the audience does have the book,
right.
You can see there seems to be these bars and dots, which also look like they could be the quills and the pens that the artisans used. Like there's pictures of the rabbit scribe, and he has these quills and pens stuck up in his headdress. So you can actually see evidences of those type of things in between the ears of the rabbit on Mars.
Okay. George, I'm sorry. For our listeners, and just in case you don't have the book, and I need to tell you, listeners, that this book, when you look at the photographs in this book, you'll be mesmerized because, it's a little bit difficult to explain it verbally about what these structures represent with regard to history and culture that we have here on Earth. And it's just a mind-boggling thing to be able to work your way through this.
They can go to the Google Books. I think our book's on Google, if they want.
Yes.
And check out
yes.
Google Books, and then the pictures are right there while
yes.
they're listening.
Yes, while they're listening, you can open up a window to do that as well. But here's a question, George, that we had in the chat room. And, we know that you're not, discovery people on Mars. You're not landing on Mars and you're not surveying and, like we do here on Earth. But wouldn't such evidence suggest that there would be some type of tools that were necessary, like there was for the pyramids here in Egypt, some types of tools or artifactual evidence?
Well, the artifactual evidence is actually the artwork that they produced. I know there's a lot of controversy with Egyptologists about who built the Sphinx. I know that they had a lot of programs on about the experts over in Egypt said that they have just recently discovered the tombs and the burial places of the people that built the pyramids. But they really have no proof of that. We don't know who built the pyramids. I mean, we don't know if actually the Egyptians built the pyramids or if it was a group prior to the Egyptians, and when the Egyptians came in, they just were enamored by the structures and started building communities around the Sphinx. It seems odd to me that you would build, like in New York City, let's say that you would build the Empire State Building, and then you would leave all the housing areas around the Empire State Building for all the people that built the Empire State Building for the whole time that the Empire State Building was there. I mean, the Sphinx and the pyramids in Egypt, they were there for thousands of years while Egypt was thriving. And it makes no sense to me that they would leave buildings around the pyramids where people lived. It just doesn't make sense to me. But they like to use that as evidence that these are the quarters and these are the tombs, the burial areas of the people that built the pyramids, because they were found in the area.
Okay,
so with Mars, what we're looking at, we're not saying that even people lived on Mars. It's more complicated than that. It's, you know, you have to have all of these dots that you have to connect through the data, which all we have from the photographs is actually these structures that we're seeing. To find out who built them, we have no idea. We can speculate about who built them, and the only evidence we have is some culture, either from our planet or elsewhere, that had a direct connection with the cultures of Mesoamerica only through their mythologies, because we're finding the parallel between these structures on Mars with the artwork and the iconography that seem to match perfectly with the images that we're finding in Mesoamerica. But of course, you know, one's on Earth and one's on Mars. And we're not finding any evidence of structures that look like, you know, where people lived. They possibly could have lived inside these structures, that the face on Mars may be, you know, a huge city with inside the mask-like feature that looks up to the sky. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, that may be the dwelling area, but we don't know.
Okay, so what is it basically that you're looking towards in continuing your research and really pinning down? What is it that you're actually trying to get to the bottom of?
Well, initially, like yourselves, we were trying to figure out, well, we're seeing these structures of the face on Mars and these surrounding things in the Sidonia area. Well, the next obvious question is, well, where did the people live? Who built these? Is there evidence of adobes or structures around there that look like, you know, a little city? Was this a ceremonial area? Did people live elsewhere? We really don't see any evidence because we've gone through tons and thousands of NASA photographs. And we find these pictographs, these bifurcated, sometimes just half images, these faces all over the place, and a lot of them that have stunning detail. But we're not seeing any evidence of little pyramids and little structures that look like cities, you know, where people would live.
Right.
It appears that whoever built these might have lived somewhere else or just lived in the spaceships that were, you know, circling the planet while they were doing this. Zachariah Sitchin, in one of his last books, discusses the idea of the face on Mars, and he believes he has evidence written in ancient Sumerian text that these structures were possibly built by Marduk, who was exiled, from the Anunnaki, and he did spend time. We mentioned this a little bit in the last chapter, but again, that's only speculation, and we're just going by the research of Zachariah Sitchin.
Right.
Either of you familiar with Zachariah Sitchin?
No, I'm not, actually.
Well, that's a whole nother can of worms.
Okay, well, we can leave that for another show.
Right. But this all deals with, the questions of your radio program, which, you know, the heart of all of this is basically, you know, who are we as human beings? Where did we come from? I mean, how are we related to these structures on Mars? And, where are we going, as a race, as a spiritual being? I mean, are we evolving? When I first met you, we were talking at the 2012 convention, where a lot of people were speculating that this was going to be a time of spiritual awakening. Is this connected because of the 2012 with the Mesoamerican connection with the same line of thinking that we're finding these structures on Mars? Are they connected to the 2012 phenomenon? We don't know. But we need to, you know, delve into this this idea that there may be an extraterrestrial force that is controlling this. But, you know, we're not sure. And again, that's just speculation. We're just trying to go with what the evidence shows us. You know, we're looking at the pictures. You know, we're not seeing McDonald's signs and 7-Elevens and little... we're not seeing any evidence of little bustling cities that are laying in ruin. What we're seeing is these huge structures that have these you know, half faces on them. We're also, in the new book that's coming out in September, we also are finding full figures that don't have to be duplicated or mirrored. A full-size parrot, a figure of a torso and a head and an arm and everything. So it's just mind-boggling, and we're finding this stuff all over the planet. And
wow.
Bill and I are thinking that there's so much evidence, there's so much stuff. I mean, we have two books already. We have enough of material for two more books that there's no way NASA can't be aware of this.
Okay, so that's the key. That's where I'd like to take this. And who was it actually that named Cydonia on Mars, the Cydonia area of Mars? Do you know where that originated?
Yeah, that went all the way back to, I can't remember his name right now, an Italian astronomer. It's written in the book. I just can't remember his name at this point. But at one time they had named all of the different areas of Mars, and a lot of them were given names out of Latin and Greek type of cities and towns and things. And this whole area on Mars was called Cydonia. And the interesting thing we find with the word Cydonia, which we mentioned in the first book, is I don't know if the listeners are familiar with the root word of Cydonia. It's also up in Arizona. We have Sedona, Arizona. And that word goes all the way back to the Bible, which were the master builders that built Solomon's temple. They were the Cydonians. And the Cydonians, the esoteric connection there is that they are, a lot of people believe, the Freemasons and the Masonic information and all of the sacred knowledge goes all the way back to the Sidonians of the Bible. They were the ones, of course, that, like I said, built Solomon's temple. So through the years, this conspiracy idea that this secret society knows all this information, and it's kind of weird that NASA would, or the this area of Mars called Cydonia just happens to have all these structures, you know, like the master builders that built these, which all this connection with the word Cydonia.
Okay, so, you know, I'm a firm believer, and Dennis, I guess if you would agree on this, you know, when we're spiked or something piques our interest and then we start to focus on something, we surely know that it expands. I mean, that's just the way energy works. That's how it works through the whole entire galaxy and probably galaxies beyond us. So, you know, in someone who's focused as much as you and William Saunders on this, I mean, it's almost inevitable that you're going to find something. Now, the thing
right,
I want to be able to...
we're looking, yes.
Right, and I just want to make that clear to our listeners. You know, anytime that we focus our energy, that's where these discoveries come. I mean, you know, I guess I could equate this to the Shroud of Turin or something like that. You know, when people have looked for evidence or, you know, these archaeological digs that we have and what we actually uncover, it is acceptable to us because we can relate to what it is that we've discovered. And I guess, George, that's where you and William, you know, spin off of Richard Hoagland's work, was that you, the two of you, actually focused on this, and now you're seeing something that we can call speculation. But when you look at these photos, and then you look at the Mesoamerican culture, would you call them geoglyphs, or I forget what you call them?
Right,
the actual drawings.
We call geoglyphs.
All right, geoglyphs on Mars, but with regard to the culture and their, you know, their totems and their language, their symbolism, that what you're saying is that this is no way something that you've concocted in your mind. There's enough evidence there that breeds, hey, you should take a look at this.
Right. Well, the face on Mars, if we only had two or three pictures from NASA to go on, that would be one argument. But NASA has continuously photographed, not to harp on the face on Mars, but they have photographed that over 20 times. So we have an enormous amount of data to look at and to confirm. And these features that Richard Hoagland first saw in the old Viking images, you know, which were kind of blurry, they're really bad images, and a lot of people criticized Hoagland in the beginning because he was looking at these very poor pictures of the Viking era. But as NASA took more and more pictures with higher resolution and better cameras, you actually could see the eye and the outline of the eye. And then they took the current image from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is the highest resolution camera yet, and it still confirms all of these features. You can see the feline eye, you can see the mouth, the muzzle, the little crown on the top of the feline side, you can see the W-shaped tri-leaf symbol. Everything stays, it's all consistent. It's not like, well, we only have one picture out of 20 that shows this, and we're sticking with this one picture. These things are confirmed repeatedly with NASA's photographs. And NASA has a particular way of addressing these images to the public. It's kind of like Clinton speak. You know, they're very careful with the way they talk. And they say, well, these pictures show that the face is not a human face. Well, it's not. So they're not saying it isn't an artificial structure. Their comment publicly is that it's not a human face, and it's not. And that's another thing I didn't mention early on when we were talking about this, is that most people, when they hear the face on Mars, they visualize that it's like Elvis Presley or Frank Sinatra, that's going to be a human-looking face. This is not a symmetrical human face. And a lot of scientists say, well, if it's not... See, they already set biases up. See, Bill and I are looking at all this information with an open mind from the beginning. We were influenced by Hoagland, so we anticipated a bifurcated structure, but we didn't like rule everything out. Scientists tend to make these very strict expectations that they're going to find in this criteria to use to show that this is artificial. And one of the first things is they say it has to be geometric, which could be like a five-sided pyramid, which we have on Mars. Or if it's a face, it has to, you know, be a perfectly symmetrical human face. Well, that's fine if you went to school in Rome and Greece, where all of the sculptures were symmetrical and beautifully carved, and you had, you know, the eyes are on the same level and everything was perfect. But if you go down to Mesoamerica, all that's thrown out the window. You know, they made these figures that were, you know, one side of the body would have a feline features, the other side would be human. So they had this melding and this composite idea. The same thing with their mask. They would have one side of the mask would be a dog, the other side would be an old man. They'd have a woman on one side and a young lion cub on the other, because this is all dealing with transformation. So it's a whole different idea. So if, as a scientist, if you already put the guidelines that this is the criteria for us to say that this is an artificial structure on the planet, that it has to be a symmetrical face to be a face, then everything that we're finding is not valid. But what we're doing is we're showing that it has direct correlation with all this iconography that we're finding in Mesoamerica. And not only that, we're finding matches that these things aren't arbitrary. The two pairings are directly related with each other.
Okay, so in its consistency, and folks, I can tell you just by looking at these pictures, and these are NASA photographs.
Yeah, we don't
available.
Manipulate pictures. We don't do anything to them, maybe just a little light and darkness adjustment, but we don't do any crazy manipulation.
Right, where you can see those shadows, and that's really nothing more than what NASA claimed to begin with, was that they were shadows. So
right, but if you look at the Mona Lisa, you know, the flat painting, that's two-dimensional art, but if you look at the Pietà,
right,
you're not going to see it if you don't have light and dark, because that's what sculpture is, three-dimensional. So
right.
The terms they use are just, it's, you know, deniability down the road once, you know, this is actually accepted in the mainstream science, NASA can say, yes, we saw that there was something there, but we said it wasn't a human face. And
right. Okay.
What your average public hears that, they say, oh, there's nothing there. See, that's not a human face. Let's move on and go watch American Idol.
Okay, you're right. But in its consistency, we're looking at not only – we're looking at the measurements as well. I mean, we're not saying the eye is over here and it really could be there. I mean, we're actually looking at mirror images. And I understand that you compiled a bunch of drawings in your research with regard to the Mesoamerican culture to compare these as well.
Yeah,
and you
being
are
an artist – one of the drawbacks when we first decided to do this book that we wanted to use all of these beautiful, glossy, you know, color pictures of these artifacts that we were collecting in books and scanning, and we quickly found out that a lot of publishers, I mean, that would end up being these huge coffee table books, you know, selling for $75 that nobody would want to buy. So I had to snap into action, and being an artist, I was able to do a lot of drawings. So the whole book is basically full of a lot of my illustrations that are you know, precise drawings of these artifacts that we're comparing the structures to. And we go beyond the normal illustrator, and we actually give where the source material was, where these images can be found. So, you know, if the reader is looking through the book and thinking that this looks too close and maybe it's a little artistic license used by Mr. Haas, they can go, you know, check the book out. We give page numbers and everything so they can verify that. And a lot of people are just blown away when they actually see the three-dimensional pictures, these black-and-white photographs of some of these Mesoamerican structures that we're comparing these features on Mars to, that they're just even more stunning.
Wow. Now, Dennis, do you have any questions
on
this?
Is Dennis still there? Is he awake yet?
Dennis, you with us?
I am. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I mean, I guess we, from a couple of listeners, we're trying to understand, you know, what some of the larger implications may be. And again, I guess without getting too esoteric, you know, and some people have posed, well, there seems to be an absence of other artifacts on the planet. But, you know, with large structures like this, there's no telling exactly how old they may be and how long they might have been there. And certainly considering the lack of
According to my co-author, he's estimating that these structures can be no older than 10 to 20,000 years old, just because of the iconography and the placement on the planet. And a lot of these seem to be in pristine condition, which was pretty amazing. So the time frame is pretty stunning.
It is pretty amazing. So
okay.
I know that you... you know, I'm sure you're about to expound on some of this in your upcoming book that I guess is due out in September, The Martian Codex?
Right. The Martian Codex comes out in September. Actually, just yesterday I got the PDF file of the final version of the book, and I've been going through that all day, so that's why I'm a little drained here. And that's got to be done by this week. So the book will be coming out in September, and it's basically part two of the Sidonia Codex. It's even more convincing, we believe, than the first edition that we put out. It has 14 chapters, and everyone is it's a mind bender, as Puzo has said in his introduction to the book. And we're very pleased with it. And our belief is that if anyone looks at these structures objectively, looking at both books, and actually reading it and looking into the images, there's no way that you can walk away from this and think that there's nothing on Mars. Even if you only walk away thinking that one of these structures are artificial, we see that as a success on our part. And if you walk away from these two books only thinking that one of these structures are artificial, that's a big step for humankind. This is something that needs to be looked at by, you know, more people than just Bill and I.
Well, indeed. I mean, indeed, if that is a big step. I mean, because, I mean, it was only 30 years ago, or perhaps even shorter than that, that, you know, Mars was deemed a dead planet. And now, and I guess,
well,
clarified that on your website as well, that there are pools, there are fossils that are available on Mars now that suggests that it was not a dead planet, that there was water inhabiting the planet. well,
there
inhabiting
seems
the
to
planet.
Be a lot of small debris, mechanical structures that you can see with the Mars Observer and the Spirit and Opportunity that are driving around up there. And NASA just takes all these pictures and they stick them up on the web. You can go look at them. There's, you know, thousands and thousands of pictures. And I think one thing NASA banks on is that your average citizen is way too busy to even look at this stuff. I mean, it's what Bill and I like to say, this stuff is hidden in plain sight. NASA puts it out there. If you're interested, you can go look at it. But they're not going to make any public comments about anything they're photographing. And it's kind of like a photographer, you know, going around taking all these pictures and then just sticking them in a drawer and telling, you know, people, well, if you go to my house and it's on the left down on Spruce Street, you can go in into the back cabinet and look at the pictures. People go, well, that's too much of a walk for me. I don't want to go down there and look at those pictures. It's the same thing with the Internet. It's just, you know, it's too much work.
Yeah, well.
And they're all just sitting there. And if you look at these pictures with the Spirit and Opportunity, there's all kinds of weird things sitting all over the place. And it appears that, you know, NASA is publicly only interested in driving up to something that looks like a rock. And if it doesn't look like a rock, they drive right past it.
Mm.
You know, move along, nothing to see here.
You know, I'm not sure that, and this was mentioned in the chat room as well, you know, what NASA is doing as far as dropping that project. We have no idea what kind of, you know,
well, we don't
satellites
know what
or
behind the scenes.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, when you say that there's no way that they can refute this type of evidence and just let it go, I mean, when we look at where the world is going right now through this evolution of change, and in, especially in consciousness and in discovery and what we're finding out, because we want to know, the answers are coming. So, you know, that's how I back up your book,
well,
you know, by saying that, you know, in corners that you look, I mean, the shamans, and how far back do they go? But the shamans were the ones who said that, you know, people, you can't see something that isn't relative to what you're familiar in seeing. But once you open those doors, then those things are revealed to you. And I think, you know, on a consciousness plane, in those waves, we're all feeling that emerge from ourselves. So if it can emerge from ourselves and we're constantly discovering more about ourselves, more about our own origins, our feelings, our emotions, and, you know, what's important to us and where that drive of humanity is going, certainly there's going to be evidence that pops up around us that helps us to understand the process of these journeys. So, you know, I'm all into this. I think it's great. But let's talk, like Dennis said, about the implications. Why do you think it's under wraps?
Well, if anybody has ever seen the movie with Jodie Foster, Contact, that may be a major reason why this is just a hot potato. First of all, for any government like our government here to go public with information like this, you know, like next week have, you know, CNN and Fox News and MSNBC, you know, all do special reports that NASA has found evidence that the face on Mars really is a structure and, you know, they're. Could you imagine how complicated this would be? It couldn't be in a 30-second soundbite. I mean, I've already been talking here for an hour, and your audience probably says, you know, what the heck is he talking about? And the first one of their first thoughts is, you know, why is this Mesoamerican stuff? I'm not Mesoamerican. Why is Mesoamerican stuff on Mars? How come it's not, you know, Chinese? How come it's not Muslim stuff on Mars? You know what I'm saying? Then you get the conflict with the different cultures. You know, what's so special about this Mesoamerican connection? And what is the reasoning that the government is trying to push this down our throats, that all this stuff on Mars has all this Mesoamerican connection? And then, of course, then you got to go into the iconography and show that all this stuff is this bifurcated, complex technique that's used and all this composite art. I mean, it's a whole educational thing. I mean, people are going to turn the channel.
Mm.
It's not a simple thing. And then, you know, how did it get there? Who built it? You know, it just goes on and on. It's very complicated. And for the government to present this, they're going to have the answers. I do talks and lectures with PowerPoint pictures and stuff all over the place, like I did at the 2012, and which the question wasn't asked there because the venue was more about the Maya and the end of time. But when I do these talks strictly with the Mars images, the first thing people want to know is, you know, why hasn't NASA mentioned this, and who built it? And, you know, for the government's not going to go forward with something like this unless they have the answers and that they can explain this. You know what I'm saying?
Mm. Well, is there anything out there? We had a question in the chat room that, you know, should the evidence, you know, be strong enough, maybe some other country or even the private sector could start a project to investigate. I mean, how many people are really into delving into what you and George and Richard have gone into?
Well, we belong to a few web groups, and there's literally hundreds of people that are participating in this, which I guess nobody even pays attention to. You know, it's like the visual aids geeky group, you know, that are in the high school that nobody pays attention to. So there's a lot of people doing this work, but it's behind the scenes. It's not breaking through mainstream because it's too mind-boggling.
Well, yeah, I've heard Oprah say stuff like that before. Why she puts things on her radio show but not on her TV show.
Right.
Because, you know, a good teacher or, you know, lecturer will really only, you know, preach to what their audience understands. So I think we're all in that. But as far as these implications go, I mean, what would that do for the major religions of the world?
Well, exactly.
Right.
And it seems like what we're finding on Mars, it is word for word in this pictographic hieroglyphics that we're finding up there, talks about the creation mythology right out of the Mesoamerican culture, which is, it's very scary and it's evil. It's very dangerous stuff. I mean, it's not a happy culture, the Mesoamerican culture. I mean, there's, you know, they dwell on death, and we're finding a lot of this imagery on Mars, skulls, and it. Some of the stuff looks, you know, almost like devil's work, you know what I'm saying? It's really dark, and I mean, how do you show people, like, you know, you would think, like, when you're a kid that, you know, in the future, NASA, the American culture, we're going to go to a planet, we're going to find ruins, and we're going to meet aliens, and we're all going to be happy. You know, it's interesting culture with this high-tech culture. And, you know, we're going to find ruins, because everybody thinks about ruins. You know, it's all going to look like Roman ruins on another planet, you know, with, like, these cathedrals and things. But what we're finding are these horrific bifurcated structures that have all of this, you know, this dark iconography on it, and it's not palatable to a lot of people.
Mm.
And we find that when we do the talks, and Bill does them up in Canada, that a lot of people are turned off by seeing this imagery that we're finding that has this connection to Mesoamerica. They think that we have, like, this preconceived agenda that, you know, Bill and I like the Maya, so we're going to find Maya stuff on Mars. I mean, it's just the other way around. I mean, we just are following the data, and this is what we're finding on Mars, this total iconographic connection with Mesoamerica, and a lot of people are turned off by that. People would be more susceptible to finding Egyptian stuff on Mars, or maybe Hindu, or finding, you know, some kind of Greek culture evidence. You know what I'm saying?
Right, but again, we're not even, when you talk 20,000 years, we're not even really talking the origin of man here, are we? I mean, you know, to pick out a Mesoamerican culture and say, hey, that looks familiar, and now...
Well, the Mesoamerican culture, again, going back to Zachariah Sitchin, he says the birth of that culture came out of the Sumerian culture, which Ningasada had gone down to South America with the black-headed people, which were his favorite. The Anunnaki supposedly created all of the five different races, you know, the Orientals and the whites and the red-skinned human beings. They
right.
built us all for different jobs that we were supposed to do for the Anunnaki, because they were living here and they used the available man that they found here, kind of like the Cro-Magnon or Neanderthal, and through genetic engineering, they made us into workers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the white Caucasian group basically worked the mines. That's why we're pale and white. We don't have any melanin in our skin because we're working in the mines. The black-headed people, which were the Negroid race, they were working out in the fields, and that's why they had the darker skin. And the Oriental race, the yellow skin, they were working up in the colder regions. So there's all this genetic reasoning for all these different race styles, which were produced by the Anunnaki. And one of the flaws, according to Zachariah Sitchin, after they used the gene pool of the available creatures that they found here, again, the Neanderthal or Cro-Magnon or whatever it was, they manipulated that with the Anunnaki to make these workers. And, again, the flaw was that they used these available, very aggressive earth beings, and they couldn't control them because the Anunnaki were kind of stoic. They were kind of like the Spock character on Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
And they just couldn't deal with these drastic, you know, love and hate emotions that human beings have. So, you know, that's a whole nother idea about, you know, how our spirituality is and what's embedded in our genes. That, you know, was it something that, was Zachariah Sitchin correct in reading these ancient texts which talk about the Anunnaki creating us as workers? I mean, are we nothing but workers? And is this what we're going to find when we indulge all this research into these structures that we're finding on Mars, say NASA goes there, and we find even more evidence of this Mesoamerican connection, which establishes Zachariah Sitchin's readings of these ancient texts? And, you know, of course, Iraq and Iran, the Mesopotamia, is one of the major problems going on in the world today.
Mm.
So this is all part of the backdrop.
Okay, so...
Now, it's not easy for them to go on TV and say, we found stuff on Mars.
Right.
Back to your original question.
Well, right.
I wouldn't,
you know, scoping the internet, I mean, there's lots of things we can find in the current day that don't make it through mainstream media, and it, you know, it doesn't surprise me. But now let's go back to like the period of the Chariot of the Gods. You know, when we came to discover all of these landing strips.
Eric von Däniken?
Yes, landing strips.
You never mentioned Eric von Däniken.
No, but I'm just talking about, all right, we find things on this planet that we discover and we try to find origins. And, you know, with this latest discovery of this missing link, which we don't really want to go into, but looking for the links that link us back to our origins. And I just find it really intriguing that not only on Earth are these types of landing strips or you know, something familiar. I mean, I'm not sure what they are, but to find this on another planet in our investigations, simply because we're out there, we're taking photographs, and we're trying to see what's out there. So when I asked you, you know, where is this taking us? Where are we going? Is it to find more of these structures, to delve into other cultures and see if those exist there as well? Or is this just a finding that we say, hey, you know, let's question this now?
Well, you're asking where we're going as a culture or where the government is going with this?
No, where you're going. I mean,
Bill and I.
Yes, and all these group members that you're speaking about, you know, what is it that you're really looking to uncover?
Well, I think the crux of the whole situation is that everybody in these groups are already, they're all convinced. It's like preaching to the choir. You know, when we present new finds and things that we want to do as a group study on some of these memberships that we belong to, everybody's in the group. They've already passed the threshold that they are convinced that there's structures on Mars already for years. So they're way past your average, you know, Joe Sixpack. It's a whole different mindset that Bill and I work with these other people, because we're already accepting that this stuff is there. And we keep finding more and more valid examples of these structures and these pictographs. So where the group would like to go is to have the public exposed to this and hopefully be as convinced as we are. And you know, we're not dealing with just one or two pictures that we have found on Mars that kind of look a little bit like, you know, the man on in the mountain that kind of looks like a face. You know, we found actual detailed structures that we were actually able to compare to an Earth-based culture that have these iconographic and motif similarities, that it's just, I don't think there's any way anybody could not accept that these structures are there. And we feel that a lot of people, they just pull away because it's I guess, the human nature. It's like,
okay.
Oh, look, there's a chicken over there. You know, oh, look at that chicken, you know, while you're telling them about Mars.
Okay.
It's like the ADD thing. Which
well,
is
you're actually being challenged in the chat room, and I think it. You know, we only have about 20.
So what have they what
left.
Have they got?
Well, number one was on Stitchin's work. Stitchin, how do you pronounce that?
Zachariah Stitchin.
Right, and the fact that, you know, where are the texts that he's translating? The Sumerian linguists have never been able to see them.
There's actual texts that. There's actual, if you go to any library, there's books that, not Zachariah Sitchin, but actual mainstream archaeologists that have written translations of the text. The Gilgamesh epic, I mean, this stuff is not a unknown type of language that, you know, only a certain amount of people can read. The Sumerian texts are written in cuneiform, which is that wedge-shaped letters and figures that they put into the clay.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
Now, you know that from being a sculptor?
No, I know that from, you know, doing research with the Sumerian cultures. It's nothing with my art background. It's just that, you know, artists of the time, I guess, we're doing these cuneiform tablets, and it's just a wedge writing. It's just a form of, you know, making the letters and the words with these pictographic shapes that were basically reduced down to these little wedge shapes. And there's people that can read these. They can read these for hundreds of years. It's just that Zachariah Sitchin has a slightly different interpretation of some of these texts that the traditional mainstream archaeologists have. And he, in his book, discusses some of these things, and he goes at length trying to explain why his interpretation is correct and the mainstream interpretation of certain words is incorrect.
Okay.
So to answer the unknown person that's asking the question, a lot of these texts that Zachariah Sitchin mentions, I agree he doesn't do a lot of footnoting, but he does mention the text by name, and they could be, you know, found and validated independently.
Okay.
That's been one criticism of a lot of Zachariah Sitchin's work, that he doesn't use a lot of footnoting and, you know, giving precise examples of where he's getting these source materials. He'll mention the text by name, but he won't say, you know, located in the British Museum. You know,
okay.
Where he gets his sources from. He basically.
Well, you know. Go ahead.
No, ask your question.
No, actually, I have a caller in the on the switchboard that would like to come on, possibly ask you a question. Would that be okay?
Sure.
Okay, hold on 1 second. Hello, 510. You're on the air. What's your name and what's your question?
Hi, this is Patrick. I'm with Midwich Radio. I just wanted to challenge the authenticity of Zachariah Sitchin's work. He has been around for years and years and years and has been basically grandfathered in as a supposed expert in the Sumerian text. Now, the first thing I want to point out is that Zachariah Sitchin has absolutely no education in this field. His degree is from the University of London in economics. And before he started writing these books, the only career that he had was as a reporter in the financial sector. Then suddenly he comes up and is able to interpret what is considered to be the most difficult language in the world to crack, which is Sumerian, and the next most difficult, which is Akkadian. And I have studied him when I first started my work. It was often compared to Sitchin's. And so what I did was I did an in-depth study into who he was. Now, I have never seen, nor have any of the Sumerian scholars ever seen, any of the texts that he is translating. Supposedly, most of them were in the museum at Baghdad, which, of course, was completely looted, and now there's nothing to even back that up. He does not provide any proof to this, and he is completely disrespected by his peers. So to class it, to tie his work into anything else, I believe lends a credibility question, and that's just, I am not, you know, personally trying to show any disrespect for the guest. But
no, I understand what you're saying, but I'd like the opportunity to respond.
Yes.
I agree, and I mentioned to our host, Susie, that Zachariah Sitchin, in a lot of his analysis of these texts, will mention the generic name of the text or whatever he's talking about, which is normally the accepted title for these tablets that he's talking about. He doesn't give any footnotes about where they're located or what verses basically he's finding these texts from. But for Bill and I, I totally agree with you in some of his techniques for finding out this information, and his research could be dubious, as you're saying. But what Bill and I were intrigued about was that what we were finding on Mars with this whole idea of Mesoamerican culture seemed to go hand in hand with his Zachariah Sitchin speculations about the brother of Marduk, Ningasada, coming down to the lower, which the text says the lower world in the text. And Zachariah Sitchin makes the leap saying that that is him talking about Mesoamerica. And you have to admit that the Sumerians did identify the black-headed people as their favorite people. And there's been a lot of scholars that have speculated about who these black-headed people are. Was he talking about people that had black hair, or who were the black-headed people? And I'm sure, as you know, reading a lot of these Sumerian texts, it's all written in a flowery, poetic manner. It's written kind of like how the Bible's written. And it's open for a lot of interpretation, I agree, and I did mention that earlier. But to make a long story short, what Bill and I were intrigued on, and which we mentioned in our last chapter of the first book, is that maybe there's more to what Zachariah Sitchin's saying because of what we found on Mars. Because he spoke about the Anunnaki having the way station on Mars, that Marduk was exiled to Mars. And he uses all these texts, which, again, are not well footnoted, but we found it very intriguing that we were finding these structures on Mars. And we even speculated in the first book in the last chapter that possibly these structures were built in a blasphemous act by Marduk on Mars, and that's why they're there, that these are the lost book. And these are the sacred...
I definitely understand. I'm just saying basically that the question of where he got these ideas, did he get these ideas, did he put them together in his own mind, which he certainly says that he has, it is not necessarily that he is so much of an expert in this. It says that he says, and in his speeches and in his appearances, he very, very clearly says he believes he has a special relationship with the Anunnaki.
Have you ever seen him live?
Yes, I have.
Well, I've seen him twice, and he's never said that he had any kind of spiritual or communications with the Anunnaki that I was aware of.
Well, he's appeared in a lot of things, but I'm not trying to disrespect what you're saying, but definitely the structures, I believe very strongly in the structures on Mars, but could that not be an evidence of an ancient civilization that lived there and for some reason is no longer there, rather than some kind of devious plot by some Sumerian god? It takes away the 12 planet concept and all that, takes away from the reality of what's there. It's absolutely fascinating what's on Mars,
right?
And the moon, apparently.
Well, since our first book, we have actually seen more evidence that possibly these structures were directly connected with some outside influence of the Maya that had to do with the city of Naranjo. Are you familiar with Naranjo in Mexico?
No, I'm...
We mentioned Naranjo a little bit in the first book. Naranjo, Mexico, they were stationed, it was a satellite city out of Tikal in Mexico. Are you familiar with Tikal?
Yes.
Cozumel? Well, they basically had this rivalry. There was this, which in, according to archaeologists and Simon, who did an extensive study of the Naranjo text, they talk about a Star Wars, which happened between these cultures. And there's a phenomenon in Cozumel, Tikal, and Naranjo, which archaeologists term as hiatus periods. Are you familiar with this?
Yes, I'm familiar with a lot of what the Mesoamerican
These hiatus periods are times when the Maya, you know, they reckon time continuously. Every time they put up a monument, it was a sacred monument, and they dated everything, and they dated when it was put up and what lord it was sanctifying and all this information. And they would constantly date everything, so everything was, you know, in a chronological order. And then there's these times when, like, for 20 years or 100 years, there's no record of anything. So Maya archaeologists call these hiatus periods, which is just an offshoot of this whole idea with this, what they call the Star Wars between Tikal and Naranjo. And Naranjo's, the patron god of Naranjo was the Zip Monster. Are you familiar with the Zip Monster?
I believe, I've heard it by another term.
Right.
But
the Zip Monster was basically the Mars Beast, which is in the Dresden Codex. And the Mars Beast is the embodiment of the planet Mars. The Maya were aware of most of the planets. They gave them these hieroglyphic, pictographic images of the different planets. The moon, they had a hieroglyphic for the moon. They had one for Venus, also for Mars. The, again, which we mentioned in the book, this whole idea about the numbering the planets, which Zachariah Sitchin talks about, the Sumerians or the Anunnaki had numbered the planets, which is, of course, another controversial thing. But there's actual evidence in Mesoamerican culture that they gave numbers to the planets also. So, again, we have this parallel with the Sumerian numbering of the planets. They numbered Venus as the number 8, eight-pointed star. The Maya, Venus was an 8-pointed star. Earth was a 7-pointed star. And the Sumerians, you had Earth as a 7-pointed star. And Mars was a 6-pointed star. And you have the same thing in the Maya culture, where the Mars is used as a hieroglyphic symbol with 6 points, which is actually the Star of David. You can embed that in there.
Wow, that's fascinating, George. And, you know, Patrick, I really welcome you on the show. We haven't seen you in a long time, and it's great to hear from you. But we only have about 10 minutes left in the show. And
well, can I finish the thing about Naranjo? I know I'm long-winded.
Yeah, as long
very
as we
quickly.
Can get some,
right.
some information in about your new book.
Right. Well, the thing about Naranjo with the Star Wars, they had this war with this called Six Earth Place, which possibly was Mars. So we have direct textual evidence in Mesoamerica discussing in Naranjo with this Star Wars, this conflict going back and forth with Six Earth Place, which was the planet, the sixth planet, which, of course, in Naranjo, the second parallel is that their patron god was a Zip Monster, which is Mars. So right in Mesoamerican culture, we have this evidence for this correlation with Mars. As you were
okay.
saying. Who was
right,
I speaking
so,
to? Your name, sir?
Actually, that was Patrick that you were speaking to.
Patrick,
he's,
yes.
He's released the line now.
Thanks for the question, Patrick.
So we wanted to use the last 10 minutes to really give our listeners an idea of what to look forward to in the upcoming book, The Martian Codex. Are you going to continue to expound upon the relationship of the Mesoamerican? And
yes, and that was not our decision. It's just that's the way the data went.
Okay.
The new book... we basically, the first chapter, we rehashed the last 30 years very quickly to give the new reader an idea of where all this is coming from. And we discussed the new image from NASA of the high-resolution the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter picture of the face on Mars, which we
right.
show in the book, basically verifies all of these features that we were talking about in the first book in this new high-resolution image. So it basically shows that this stuff is actually there. It's not tricks of light. And we discussed the European Space Program, the ESA releases that they put out, also verifying all of these features on the face on Mars. From that point, the new book discusses the D&M pyramid, which we didn't have time to talk about in the first book, the DiPietro and Molinari discovery of the five-sided D&M pyramid, some other structures in the Sidonia area, and then the last half of the book, or the remainder of the book, we discuss the similar Mesoamerican-type structures that are found out all over the planet. So we go from different areas of the planet showing that we're finding these same structures like we're finding in Mesoamerica or in Sidonia that have the same Mesoamerican connection. And unlike a lot of the structures in Sidonia that are these half and bifurcated images, we're also finding structures outside of Sidonia that are full images. They don't have to be duplicated or mirrored. So these are pretty stunning also, profiled faces, things like that. So people that don't like this mirroring idea, we're showing them in the second half of the book structures that don't need any type of manipulation. We have a torso of, from the waist up, head and arm and everything, of an Olmec-like figure. We have a full-size parrot, which was analyzed by three separate veterinarians, and they found 18 points of anatomical correctness in this bird. So it goes way beyond any kind of, speculation that these are just, tricks of light and shadow and chance formations by nature.
Okay. So, Dennis, do you have any more questions? Because I would like to make an announcement before we end the show. But, George, I want to thank you for coming on board today, and to have just witnessed you dedicate your life to uncovering, this really intriguing information, and I'm sure it's
well
worth
the ride.
Well, I
have the opportunity because I'm a kept man. My wife works hard, and she gives me the opportunity to sit at home and do this research all day long.
Well, that's nice, right?
What a
that's
woman!
Wonderful. Well, you never know what you're gonna, end up finding. For us, and certainly I wish you well on your journey. And for our listeners, Dennis, did you have another question?
No, nothing that we have time for.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe after the second book comes on, we can delve into this a little deeper. But I would like to make an announcement, George, just before you part with us, and you can tell us what you're on to next. There is a researching the human energy field, and this is kind of extends off of Bruce Lipton's appearance last week. There's a lecture with Dr. Thornton Schreeder on Saturday and Sunday, June 20th and the 21st next week in Laguna Beach, California, and that's at Oasis Child on Glen Eyre. And I just wanted to reach out to everyone and announce this, that it's a really great opportunity to hear of one of the world's leading scientific experts in the field, biofield and healing industries. And you can call Leanne Connolly at 949-310-6295 to find out about getting tickets. I think it's $150, and that's lunch included for both days if you register for before tomorrow. So we promised we'd mention that. And so I want to thank you all. And, George, do you have any last comments you'd like to say to our listeners?
Well, I'd like to thank you and Dennis for having me on. And if anybody out there is interested in looking into this information, they can visit our website at thesidoniainstitute.com. That's thesidoniainstitute.com. It's all one word. And the website has all kinds of information, information about the book and a lot of the discoveries, current discoveries that we're making that are posted on this website of ours. So if they're interested in pursuing this, again, check out our website.
Wonderful. And what's next for you now?
I'll be appearing at the Fortean group in West Virginia coming up on, I think, the 27th of the month. in West Virginia somewhere. So. And
somewhere? We don't know where?
If you go onto the Fortean website, the Fortean Institute, there you can find that information out. But as for the rest of the year, we're finishing up. We just got the final PDF file of the new book, and we're going through that to make sure everything's in order. And the book will be out in September, and we'll probably be trying to promote that on this program again, hopefully, and doing book signings at Barnes & Noble and those type of venues, trying to get the message out.
Yeah, obviously, and we'll be looking, I think, a little closer to these NASA photos, you know, when they arrive. I think they float around Facebook and float around the Internet, and perhaps it might cause someone to stop and take a look, you know, and further research. So yeah. I know those that, you know, have the mind of science and want to go forward, this is really a great opportunity and a great portal to enter into. So I thank you again, George, for joining us.
Well, thank you.
And best of luck with your new book.
And
anyone that's interested, on the show page, if you click on George's photo on the show page, it will take you directly to his website to further investigate.
I'll have to try that.
What's that?
I'll have to try that.
Okay, great.
So Dennis, my face is a hot link, huh?
Yes, your face is a hot link.
Yes,
indeed. And I just want to announce also to our listeners that next week we will not be broadcasting in honor of Father's Day. We have a lot of fathers over here and a lot of traveling to do, so we will not be broadcasting, and we'll be returning on June 28th with Dr. Christine Page, back by popular demand, and we'll be discussing the frontiers of health and where the holistic medicine is taking us. And, you know, how that's going to actually change our health paradigms in the future. So we're really excited. Thank you so much for joining us, everyone. It's been a controversial topic, and we hope you enjoyed the time that you spent with George and Dennis and I. And Dennis, would you like to give some last words?
I just had a great time, and really appreciate getting the chance to meet and speak with you today, George, on grateful that all the listeners joined us today for this journey. And hope to talk to everyone again in 2 weeks.
All righty. Great. Well, thanks so much, everyone, for joining us. And we hope to see you soon. And remember to find the joy in enjoying your journey. Thank you, George. Thank you, Dennis. And thank you, everyone in the chat room. Take care now. Bye-bye.